Press TV.
The headlines: three more Palestinians are killed in yet another Israeli military raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says that Tehran would continue to support Syria and help it with reconstruction efforts as the two countries sign a comprehensive agreement. And Ukraine reports fresh Russian airstrikes and shelling a day after Moscow accused Kiev of being behind a drone attack on the Kremlin. Welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Israeli forces have killed three Palestinians and injured four more during a raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The regime's troops surrounded the city's old area early in the morning and besieged a house belonging to a resistance member. They resorted to live fire and tear gas against locals protesting against the raid. They also prevented medical teams and ambulances from reaching the area. The slain Palestinians carried out an anti-regime operation in the Jordan Valley last month, which led to the death of three Israeli forces. Meanwhile, the resistance forces shot down an Israeli drone over a village. Israel has rather stepped up attacks across the occupied territories. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year. Our correspondent Mona Candil is joining us now from Ramallah with more updates on the events that took place today. Mona, the funeral procession taking place there. Walk us through what's taking place right now.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in order to take part in the funeral processions of three Palestinians who had been killed by the Israeli forces earlier this day in Nablus city, in the old town of Nablus. Mu'adh al-Masri, Hassan Qatnani, and Ibrahim Jabir. At least two of those three martyrs, as the Israeli military claimed, they were responsible for the shooting that took place in the Jordan Valley near Ariha on the 7th of April, and that led to the killing of three Israeli settlers. The third Palestinian who was killed with the two martyrs responsible for the Jordan Valley shooting, as the Israeli military said, had secured them and protected them while he was with them, and he of course was martyred as well. The Palestinian Ministry of Health said that the faces of two Palestinian martyrs have been deformed completely due to the heavy fire they were hit with, making it difficult to identify them at first. The Israeli military sent soldiers to Nablus city and the old town, to the Yasmina neighborhood, the Shin Bet, the intelligence undercover units as well. However, they claim that explosive drones succeeded to assassinate those three Palestinians, and it's a new tactic the Israeli military had been using in order to identify those are wanted for them and assassinate them better for them from arresting them. At the end of the day, clashes took place between the Palestinian residents of the old town of Nablus, as well as the Israeli soldiers. We are receiving now, as the Israeli military claims, there is a shooting took place, or an operation took place at the Hawara military checkpoint. That's the entrance to Nablus city, and that the Israeli forces opened fire at the Palestinian vehicle. We have to wait to get more information about this operation that had taken place at the entrance to Nablus city.
All right, thanks a lot, Monab Kandil, joining us from Ramallah. Staying with the issue, Palestinian author Mazen Ghamsia says the Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its acts of aggression against Palestinians with impunity.
So the use by Israel of administrative detention for those they have under their control and use of murders, basically assassination for those that they want, so to speak, like in Nablus happened today, is typical of colonial powers, what they are doing and how they operate, to try and terrorize basically the local population into submission. Of course, this is a failing strategy and won't work. There's one word to describe the Western hypocrisy. That is hypocrisy, is what I call is basically double standards and collusion. Hypocrisy, collusion are words that come to mind. Collaboration with occupiers and colonizers. Treachery are words that come to mind, but these are things that are also expected in some fashion, because the Western world has never been about human rights or international law or justice or protection of civilians.
Palestinian activist and detainee Sheikh Qadir Adnan has been martyred in an Israeli prison after nearly 3 months of hunger strike over his illegal imprisonment. The regime even refused his family visitation rights right up to his death. Palestinians view his martyrdom as a renewed call to action against Israeli colonialism, occupation, and apartheid.
A well-known resistance actor within the Palestinian prisoners movement, Qadir Adnan, has passed away on the 86th day of his hunger strike inside an Israeli prison following 2 decades of arrests. Qadir spent nearly a fifth of his life behind bars, arrested 12 times by Israeli forces and subjected to over 8 years of captivity. He used hunger strikes to take power back and mobilize the world outside his prison cell in support of the Palestinian prisoners' struggle. Sustained arbitrary arrests and medical neglect led to Qadir's death. The Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council thus viewed Qadir's killing as premeditated murder by the Israeli regime. Israeli prison services were holding Qadir in solitary confinement and refused his family visitation rights right up to his death. He survived by his wife and 9 children. In his lifetime, Qadir Adnan carried out 6 hunger strikes. His first protest in 2004 lasted 25 days and popularized hunger strikes as an accessible means of resistance within the regime's military prison system. His second hunger strike in 2012, that lasted 66 days, was joined by hundreds of prisoners and triggered an international movement for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. In 2015, he went on his third hunger strike for 56 days against another administrative detention. In 2017, Qadir was again arrested and went on a 58-day hunger strike. His fifth 25-day-long strike was directed at his penultimate arrest in 2021. During his most recent arrest in February, Israeli forces raided his home and terrorized his family. Qadir was no stranger to civil disobedience, therefore responded by immediately going on an open hunger strike. Israeli prison services retaliated with isolation orders, renewed every 2 weeks without review. He was held under deplorable conditions and was subjected to regular abuses. When Qadir fell seriously ill in April, ISP refused to transfer him to a hospital. Qadir was found unconscious in isolation in Ramallah Prison Clinic on May 2nd. Using deliberate medical neglect, indefinite isolation, and detention extensions, the regime foresaw and facilitated Qadir's death. He was killed behind the bars, a fate shared by over 233 Palestinian political prisoners. The international community's failure to intervene amplifies past evidence that international law is just a tool for the colonizer regime of Israel, not Palestinians. It shows that the international community aids and abets the Israeli regime's crimes by its deafening silence that today rings loud after the death of Qadir Adnan.
Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Qadir Adnan's death in an Israeli jail sparked anger in Palestinian territories. Palestinian factions hold the Israeli regime responsible for his death, saying that Tel Aviv will pay dearly for its crime.
Palestinians rallied in Gaza City as shops closed during a general strike following the death of Palestinian hunger striker Qadir Adnan in Israeli custody. In his hometown near Jenin, in the occupied West Bank, Adnan's 9-year-old son, Ali, led a protest march. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya described the death of Adnan, who was arrested in the occupied West Bank, as a deliberate assassination.
The Palestinian cabinet holds the Israeli occupation, the prison authorities and all its agencies fully accountable for the martyrdom of Qadir Adnan. And we consider this a deliberate assassination by rejecting his request for release, neglecting him medically and keeping him in his cell despite the seriousness of his health condition.
Also, different Palestinian factions held the regime responsible for his death, saying that Israel will pay dearly for its crime.
The occupation bears full responsibility, and we will carry out our role in confronting those crimes and those assaults, in particular this crime which led to the martyrdom of Sheikh Hero Qadir Adnan.
Gaza-based Hamas resistance movement has also warned that the Israeli crime will not go unanswered. Also, the Fatah movement of President Mahmoud Abbas has called for immediate international action in support of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails. According to Palestinian Prisoner Society, 4,900 Palestinian detainees are currently in Israeli jails, with 1,000 of them being held in administrative detention without charge. That's the highest number since 2003.
Tehran has reacted to Washington voicing concern over Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Syria. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the White House's anger over Raisi's visit to Damascus is a bit natural. He said Washington is enraged as Iran and the resistance front have countered the influence of the wicked U.S. regime in Syria and the region as a whole. Tehran's reaction came after Principal Deputy Spokesperson for the U.S. State Department expressed concern over Iranian President's landmark trip to Damascus. Vedant Patel said the enhancement of Iran-Syria ties should be a cause of concern for the U.S., the countries in the region, and the whole world. Iran's president began his trip to Damascus on Wednesday. Raisi, in a meeting with his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad, said Tehran would continue to support Damascus with help it with reconstruction efforts.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi arrived in Damascus on Wednesday leading a high-ranking delegation. The president then headed to the presidential palace where he was received by his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad with an official welcoming ceremony. The two officials held talks in which Assad underlined the importance and depth of relations with the Islamic Republic. He noted that both countries share visions based on respecting mutual interests and the two countries' sovereignty. Assad thanked Iran for its mediation efforts in Syria-Turkey peace talks and expressed support for Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy. Raisi, for his part, congratulated Assad on Syria's victory in the war on his country, hailing resistance as an effective tool for free people of the world. He stressed relations between Syria and Iran were never affected by regional or international developments, reiterating his country's support for the people and government of Syria.
We discussed different topics as well as means of boosting our bilateral relations. We are determined to develop and expand our ties with regional states without a presence of foreigners, as they only cause instability. We should get rid of U.S. forces in our region. Securing Syria's sovereignty necessitates the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
The two presidents signed a long-term strategic comprehensive cooperation agreement. Ministers of both countries also signed a number of memorandums of understanding in the fields of oil, agriculture, rail and aerial transportation, free trade zones, earthquake reliefs, communications and information technologies.
Agreements today, as well as projects discussed, will push forward our relations through mechanisms that will increase the bulk of trade exchange and investments. This would reduce the impact of economic sanctions, especially at a time when world economic balance is shifting eastwards, and this would liberate world economies from Western hegemonies.
Assad also welcomed the restoration of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Officials are also set to discuss the establishment of a joint bank and insurance entity that would facilitate trade. The visit further consolidates the already historic and strong ties between Iran and Syria. It clearly launches a new phase of economic partnership following a successful military and political collaboration that set an example in the region in fighting terror and foiling U.S. and Western plots. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has highlighted the negative impacts of U.S. sanctions on Iranian citizens. Amir Saidi Ravani, in identical letters to U.N. Chief Antonio Guterres and President of the General Assembly, Kasaba Karosi, called anti-Iran U.S. measures unilateral and illegal. He said the sanctions hamper Iran's efforts to address challenges related to environment, health, and welfare of the people. The Iranian diplomat referred to a recent WHO report that acknowledged some environmental factors as the reasons for deaths in the country. He said the U.S. sanctions hinder Iran's access to new technologies as well as investment on environmental projects. Iravani, in the letter, stressed that the U.S. must take responsibility for its wrongdoing against the Iranian people. And Ukraine says Russia has targeted cities in a new wave of missile strikes and shelling across the country. Officials and media outlets say multiple explosions were heard in the capital, Kiev, and elsewhere in the past 24 hours. Blasts caused by Russian shelling were also reported in the southern Zaporizhia region and the port city of Odessa. The new wave of attacks come less than a day after Russia accused Ukraine of a drone strike on the Kremlin. Moscow described the incident as a failed terrorist act aiming to kill President Vladimir Putin. Kiev has denied involvement in the alleged attack. Our correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Miller, earlier told us that the drone attack on the Kremlin might draw a serious response from Russia.
Well, yes, as you say, Russia accuses Ukraine of carrying it out. Ukraine says that, or at least the president says that it wasn't them. Former Russian President Medvedev has said that now that after this attack, Russia should target or eliminate Zelensky. This may well prove a change of Russian policy in perhaps looking at regime change, looking at getting rid of Zelensky rather than demilitarizing Ukraine and forcing them to cede territory, which was the aim in the past. So this event, we'll have to wait and see what Russia's response is. How seriously they take it, whether they try to downplay it, or whether they strike back in a stronger manner. Of course, there's many buildings, decision-making centers in the center of Kiev, the president's office, the parliament, which Russia hasn't attempted to strike yet. We've been speculating for months that Russia may well, in the future, step up what they see as legitimate military targets. And if they feel that Ukraine is trying to attack or even assassinate President Putin or attack the Kremlin, then Russia may well strike back on Ukrainian decision-making centers. So we'll have to see in the coming days just what response Russia will have to this attack.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Whoa. 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 Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Rating agency Fitch has downgraded France's credit rating. The agency says France's social unrest over pensions could limit the government's ability to pass new structural changes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, rating agency Fitch has downgraded France's sovereign credit rating, warning that public resistance to a recent pension reform could take a toll on the economy. The agency lowered the rating from AA to AA- with a stable outlook. The downgrade means France is considered a more risky venture for investors, which could lead to higher borrowing costs. Fitch believes that social and political pressures illustrated by the protest against the pension reform will complicate fiscal consolidation, the agency wrote. It added that the government's decision to bypass a parliamentary vote to push through the pension reform will likely further strengthen radical and anti-establishment forces. Political deadlock and sometimes violent social movements pose a risk to Macron's reform agenda and could create pressures for a more expansionary fiscal policy or a reversal of previous reforms, Fitch warned. French President Emmanuel Macron signed the unpopular pension reform into law in mid-April, despite months of nationwide protests and resistance in Parliament. The measure raised the retirement age from 62 to 64. Following its enactment, the political opposition and unions vowed to continue contesting the move. Analysts have warned that as the president's party does not have a parliamentary majority, it may be difficult for it to deliver on other reforms due to the public unrest. French Economy Minister Bruno Le Maire, however, pledged that Paris will continue structural reforms despite Fitch's warnings. I believe that the facts invalidate the assessments by the Fitch agency. We are able to implement structural reforms, and we will continue to implement structural reforms for the country, Le Maire told Agence France-Presse recently. The official vowed to accelerate the country's debt reduction to restore the public finances, reduce deficits, and make faster cuts to public expenditure. sales volumes at major retail chains in France have declined in the first 3 months of the year against a backdrop of soaring prices. News channel BFMTV reported recently, citing a study by analytical center Des Ricana Institute. BFMTV stated, faced with inflation, the French reduced their purchases in the first quarter. According to the Circana Institute, supermarket sales in the first 3 months of this year fell by 5% compared to 2022. It indicated that surging prices pushed the turnover of large-scale retailers up by 9.1% during the same period in annual terms. Data showed that sales of oils have been the most affected, plummeting by 53.1%. Sales of care and hygiene products reportedly dropped by 52.8%, while starch sales declined by 26.4%. The cost of living crisis has deepened in France. According to a recent report by statistics agency INSEE, inflation in the Eurozone's second largest economy continued to grow at a record pace and rose faster than expected in February, largely due to surging food prices. Food services and manufactured goods have been the main contributors to rising inflation. French authorities previously introduced a so-called anti-inflation food basket comprising about 50 basic items and have obliged large retailers not to hike prices on these essentials. Inflation in France continues to soar at a record pace and rose faster than expected in February, largely due to surging food prices, according to the most recent calculations by statistics agency INSEE published recently. Consumer prices increased from a projected 7.2% to 7.3% in February year-on-year, up from 7% in January, and representing the strongest increase in France's euro area, INSEE said. This latest report shows that food, services, and manufactured goods have been the main contributors to rising inflation. Earlier this month, the government warned French households that inflation will accelerate to reach 10% in March, which means that food prices will also increase by 10%. The country's authorities have introduced a so-called anti-inflation food basket comprising about 50 basic items and have obliged large retailers not to hike prices on these essentials. French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire said he expected inflation to reach a peak this summer and then start to ease. Banque de France Governor François Villeroy de Gallo acknowledged that inflation across the Eurozone remained too high and continues to be the main concern and top priority for monetary policy.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It is the first visit by an Iranian president to Syria since the war on Syria began.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has visited the country with much fanfare. A long-term cooperation agreement and a major oil deal have been signed already. The question is, why has Iran decided now is the time for this visit? And in that context, what does the forging of closer ties between the two countries mean for the entire region, especially since Syria is being embraced back into the fold by other Arab countries? Those are some of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me bring in Mick Napier first, activist and commentator, who joins us from Edinburgh. Mick Napier, welcome. So let me first initially get your reaction to this, because this is an important visit that has been done at this point. It's a two-day visit by the Iranian president since the war on Syria began back in the year 2011. What's your impression of it?
Well, the Americans have seized a part of Syria, which, surprise, surprise, contains most of the most valuable oil resources. America's trying to isolate and overthrow the regime in Damascus. It's ratcheting up pressure on Iran. It's trying to build alliances across the Middle East to isolate these two states in order to either achieve regime change or to bend them to the American will. I think the visit by the Iranian leader to Damascus is a symptom of something radically changing in the Middle East. We all saw how China was able to effect a reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We've seen the knock-on effects of that in Yemen already. But certainly in Syria, we can see that the efforts by the USA to isolate and force its allies in the Middle East to isolate Syria are breaking down. Saudi Arabians are working for rapprochement with Damascus. There's talks about reintegrating Damascus into the Arab League. And I think this visit from Tehran to Damascus talks of this is a symptom of this new situation where American power in the region is clearly declining, and its ability to enforce its will, divide and isolate the key countries in the region against each other, is faltering, is actually failing. So it's a visit greatly to be welcomed.
You know, when you first started talking about, when I asked that question, McNapier, you talked about the U.S. goals, which was to ratchet up pressure on Iran and going for regime change. But, you know, these are things and approaches that have failed, as you just said there in your last statement there. Why do you think the U.S. is clinging on to it? Because if you really think about it, which countries are on the U.S. side right now? You have all the allies that were mainly Saudi Arabia being one of the major ones, who's no longer on the side of the U.S. when it comes to Syria. The only entity that is standing out is the Zionist regime or Israel and U.S. All the other countries are uniting. So doesn't that put the U.S. in an odd position, to say the least?
I mean, what a transformation over the last couple of decades. America really believed it could invade, crush the Iraqi people, could crush the Syrian people. And its whole idea was kind of mapped out as early as the end of the Second World War, where a key American diplomat said that Middle Eastern oil was, quote unquote, the greatest prize in the history of the world. And America was determined to dominate access to that oil. It installed a puppet regime in Iran, together with the British. It installed client regimes across the Middle East, because its idea was basically very simple. It's not that America needs the oil. America is often a net exporter of oil. But if it could control access to that oil, then it would exert tremendous influence on it, on Japan and China and other places around the world who wanted access to that key resource. Now, fast forward to the present day, the carefully crafted alliances, the day when Saudi Arabia would bend over backwards, with very few exceptions, but would bend over backwards to please the Americans. Those days seem to be gone. And I think the view from Washington now is that the Chinese mediation between Tehran and Riyadh was really contemptuous of the USA. and it did not give the dominant imperial power in the region since the Second World War, it didn't give that power its due place. So yes, the tectonic plates of regional politics are shifting, and they're not shifting to the advantage of the USA.
And in a sense, when you take a look at what has happened based on how you said a tectonic shift, you know, these regional alliances, you wouldn't think of it even months ago, because when you had this agreement and reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia take place, I mean, I don't know if we can believe the CIA chief or not, but he said that the U.S. was, in a sense, blindsided. But what's more important over here is a terminology that the U.S. Would hate for it to stand, but now it's stronger probably than ever, and that's this axis of resistance, which Syria is now back in the fold of the Arab countries and has solidified itself in that respect. How do you think the U.S. feels when it looks at what has occurred there? And to add to that, we have seen how Saudi Arabia, possibilities of Saudi Arabia not only reconciling with Hamas, but also in the past day or two, for there to have been some positive overtures when it comes to Hezbollah. I'm sure Israel is not too happy to hear this.
What a transformation. Back in 2006, when Hezbollah scored an astonishing victory over the Israelis, denied the Israelis victory, the overwhelmingly superior military force through the courage and the intelligence and the strategic and tactical brilliance of its fighters. When that defeat was inflicted upon Israel, the word in among knowledgeable individuals was that the Saudis were very unhappy and were hoping for a Hezbollah defeat. Now, I wasn't there in the Chancellery, so I don't know, but that's certainly not the case anymore. Look, every time an Arab state normalizes with the apartheid regime in Israel, they pay a price with their own public opinion, which never follows them. The Egyptians have had a so-called peace treaty with Israel for many decades, but it's a cold peace, and the Egyptian people, in their overwhelming majority, disapprove of it and want to see the Egyptian regime challenge stand with the Palestinians against Israel. So yeah, this is remarkable. I think the idea is, the question is, who will control the resources of the region? I think America has probably given up in its original plan to control those resources and to admit friendly regimes on preferential terms to those resources, whether they be in Iran under the Shah, in Iraq under American occupation, or in Syria or elsewhere. I think that plan is in ruins. It now has to try to sow... America's not like Israel. They're very different. But Israel can only exist as a state of 10 million Zionist Jews, a Jewish supremacist state, against the entire people of the region, 280, 300 million people. I mean, it should never exist because it's so tiny and weak.
Right.
It can only exist with an air bridge of arms and weapons and economic advantage from the USA and Europe, but also by devastating neighboring countries, by making sure that neighboring countries in the Middle East are weak and broken, as was the attempt with Iraq, as was the attempt on Syria and elsewhere. So any coming together of local forces in the Middle East, states and other actors who want to see local control of this, of key local resources, who want to develop the Middle East, as China has developed in the last 50, 60 years. China used to be a basket case. China used to be a land of famine and hunger and different countries seizing parts of China. But China has developed and has become a major world power. People in the Middle East who want to share in the wealth of this wonderful planet, who don't want to live under foreign subjugation, who don't want to be suffering the threat of attack by Israel, by America's little Prussia, America's little Sparta, America's nuclear-armed Israel. Those people who want freedom and a better life for themselves through local control of resources seem to be winning very much against the American grand plan,
sure.
if you take the long view.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me bring in our political analyst John Busnich into the program and get his thoughts on this. John Busnich, welcome to the Spotlight.
Thank you.
Let's take a look at what has happened over here when you take a look at this visit. And I want to come at you with the regional landscape of which when you take a look at the map and you take a look at the countries and how they've aligned themselves with each other, of course, Iran and Saudi Arabia being the big ones, of which then the rest somewhat followed, in a sense, you're only left with U.S. and the Zionist regime or Israel vis-a-vis the rest, especially when it comes to Syria. Tell us how Iran, especially in this visit, has solidified its relationship with Syria as the rest of the Arab countries are bringing Syria back into the fold, and then putting into question the U.S. presence. And, of course, in that context, maybe you could put Israel in there as to how it's bombing Syria every other day, it seems.
Well, you know, reality has finally arrived in the Middle East because with the assistance of China, the main consumer now of the oil and gas products of the region, we see China trying to secure a stable economic output that is not affected by the divide and conquer politics of the United States. The United States was trying to play Saudi Arabia off against Iran to try to break Iran's contact with China and with Russia. The United States has failed miserably in this effort, and the United States itself was being used as an actor by the Israel lobby, which we know is the most powerful lobby in Washington and which literally controls the majority of both political parties in the United States.
But McNapp here, there was a major cooperation agreement signed. It was called the Long-Term Strategic Cooperation. At the same time, you had a large Iranian delegation that accompanied the Iranian President Raisi in different fields like oil, aviation, railways, and agriculture. You have these Arab countries that are interested in investing in Syria, and Iran's president made it a point to talk about how it is interested, obviously, in the reconstruction. But how can any of this happen? Maybe Iran shouldn't be put into this question in that respect. When you have the U.S. and the sanctions against Syria, or sanctions against Iran for that matter, because some of these Arab countries, they're not under sanctions. So how can this part of the puzzle be solved in order for Syria to really stand on its own 2 feet economically and for trade to pursue?
You know, the issue of sanctions is reaching such a stage now that the last figure I saw was that America and its allies were sanctioning about 30% of the countries of the world. I believe, for example, that an American British delegation with absolute temerity went to Kazakhstan last week to threaten the government there that if they continue to trade with Russia, they themselves would suffer sanctions from America and Britain and the EU. So the sanctions have become so broad that they've forced other countries to look for alternatives to the US dollar for their bilateral trading, and this seems to be becoming pretty significant, at least in terms of an article I read in the Financial Times recently. I'm not an expert, but it seems that, the sanctions are a weapon of war. Sanctions or pre-war, sanctions were used against Iraq to famously or infamously kill 500,000 Iraqi children before the US invaded. And sanctions are being used to cripple countries, to inflict terrible punishment upon people from Cuba to Venezuela to Syria and elsewhere. And it's the imperial power and its allies which are inflicting this punishment. But it basically comes down to the threat of, if you will not be my friend, then I will punch your face. That's a paraphrase of a German proverb. It's threats and violence which are used, because the USA knows that in terms of producing goods, America was the humming workshop of the world after 1945. Now it's China. China is far and away the neighboring countries, the biggest manufacturing pole in the world, and that's changed the balance. So America can only deal with its decline, its relative decline economically, by using military power and threatening the use of military power. And it does so very promiscuously. So any alliance across the region, in the region, between complementary economies in the region, benefits the people of the region. And it means that the American shadow hanging over the region becomes that bit less dark.
Well, something's got to be figured out there, because isn't it just John Bosnich when Iran signs, for example, a major oil deal with Syria, but you have the U.S. stealing Syrian oil? You know, that just doesn't make sense. And then making money off of it, I'm not too sure where that money is going, really. But, that's just one of the things that's just perplexing.
America is showing itself to be the hypocrite of all hypocrites here. America is the country that is telling the world that it supports free trade and competition and free enterprise, and yet it is the single biggest block to free competition and free enterprise that exists on the earth. America has all of these countries under sanctions because it wants to use economics to dictate politics to other countries. It also wants to dictate culture and ethnic relations between nations which have been friends among themselves and lived and coexisted in peace for generations and centuries and even millennia until America came and set them at each other's throats. America has inherited the English curse of divide and conquer in the interests of their empire. And the world is now smartening up to this. We cannot be allowed to be forced to fight among ourselves. I was here in Serbia during the crippling sanctions that America used to try and crush Serbia. They had no effect. The people banded together. I was in Japan when America was sanctioning Japan and I was advising the Prime Minister's office. They did not cow Japan. Japan continued to produce. I have been in Canada when American interests imposed sanctions on our wood industry. America is the global bully. And as the nations of the world wake up to this fact, the bully, when it's outnumbered by all countries in the earth, will fail and fall. And this is how empires fall. This is the fall of America. They, by sanctioning the world, are sanctioning themselves.
Well, John Bosnich, I need to ask you how then this will impact the relationship that some of these Persian Gulf countries have. For example, how will Saudi Arabia be impacted by this, or the UAE? When it comes to their interest in rebuilding Syria, for example, making investments in regional countries, including Iran, isn't that kind of a sign that it's the beginning of some kind of divergence in their relationship away from the U.S.?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the critical player in this matter, because this is an economic issue, sanctions are an economic tool to achieve a political goal. And China is now the richest economy, the fastest growing economy, the most vibrant and competitive economy in the world. And it is not subject to American pressures. These countries must trade with each other. And what America is doing with its sanctions regime is forcing the other countries of the world to band together for their own mutual survival. Given a choice between survival and profit, everybody will choose survival. That leaves America out in the cold, and it leaves the rest of the world to find substitute products to replace the things they bought from America. And if America sanctions them further, then the Russian and Chinese and Iranian and Libyan and Venezuelan economies and others will band together to cut off the things that America needs from the rest of the world. And when it doesn't get those things, America will collapse.
And final question goes to you, McNapier. As we've discussed, if we're looking at all these countries to solidify their relationship, such as Saudi Arabia and Iran, as they are doing, along with Iran and other countries, and all of them really, to be on the one side, how can Israel then pursue its bombing campaign of Syria? Shouldn't Israel be intimidated by the fact that you have all these countries now, and they're interested in enhancing their relationship, and in the case of Syria, Israel continues to bomb them? Doesn't that put a wedge between, let's say, these countries and Israel, obviously some of which there is one, and will that make Israel think twice when it comes to bombing Syria?
Well, I mean, the price that we pay for American military adventures is massively high. They've just been kicked out of Afghanistan, but America paid or invested or spent $2.3 trillion in order to devastate Afghanistan, install a kleptocracy, and finally, after devastating the country, be expelled. So there's a high price to be paid to defeat these adventures. But Israel is a microcosm of America in many ways. It simply uses violence to enforce its will. America has always used violence. Bill Clinton apologized to the people of Central America some years ago for turning the whole place into a charnel house. America invades more countries in the world than any other, than the rest of the countries put together. So it's extremely violent, and so is Israel. But with the decline of American power in the region, with its America shifting attention to the Pacific, Israel will become weaker. But it will not abandon its position willingly. It will try to enforce its will, and the danger is it may try and seize the opportunity before it becomes weaker to expel the Palestinians. So there's dangers ahead.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Thank you. And McNapier, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to english@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, and he was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was brought up in the house of Nubuwa, Prophethood, and Imamat, a house by which Allah had honored the Muslims all across the world. And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam grew up in the shade of that honored and noble house, while he received high ideals, morals, values, knowledge, and wisdom from his father, the eighth divinely appointed Imam, who shed rays of light from his great soul unto Imam al-Jawad. Imam al-Jawad's father, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, himself had undertaken the upbringing, the nurturing, the education of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And so we find that Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam took Imam al-Jawad with him wherever he went and fed him with his own hands. A divinely appointed Imam, nurtured and educated by a divinely appointed Imam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed Imam. We have constantly heard that the Almighty Allah is so merciful, He is so forgiving, He is so grateful to His servants. Now, what is really interesting is that the servant should be grateful to the Almighty Allah, but we find that the beneficent, the merciful, the most nurturing and nourishing Lord, the ultimate Creator, the Almighty Allah, is the one who is truly grateful to the servant. And the servant can never be grateful to the extent that the Almighty Allah deserves. And still, the Almighty Allah, the beneficent, the merciful Allah, the compassionate Allah, the kind Allah, He says that if you as a servant are grateful to Him as the Master, He will increase your blessings. There's a beautiful conversation between Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam and one of his companions in which they speak about these blessings of the Almighty Allah, and they speak about gratefulness, something that in the fast-paced world of the present day, we tend to forget. We tend to forget to be grateful to the Almighty Allah, and we tend to forget the vast array of blessings that the Almighty Allah has given every single one of us.